This is going to be my testimony about a couple of miracles that happened in my life. And I am really honored to be here because Michelle and I were reading last night in the Bible, and it's talking about how you should surround yourself with men of character. And I think I've met that task this morning. Everybody has miracles that happen. Beyond a doubt, we know that. And it seems like the older we get, the more you look back, the more you realize these things are miraculous. You don't really pay a lot of attention at the time. I've had a couple of things happen in my life where I have, without a doubt, at that moment, I knew it was a miracle. And I'm sure we all have. But I call this twice healed. And I thank Mike and my wife for doing this because I can't even operate this thing. So, this is going to be some law enforcement stuff. And I've got permission from everybody whose name I use and everything. So, and a little of it will be kind of graphic, and a little of it, one of the few things I have in common with Richard speaking is I'm politically incorrect. 20 years ago, that was called telling the truth, but now it's political incorrectness. But I want to go ahead and apologize if I goof anything up. I'm prone to do that, but told you. Not too long ago in a galaxy far, far away, that was me. Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. I was a deputy right out of high school, and I started here in Gilmer County and finished up in Gordon County. That's where Mr. Timms is, where we met down in Gordon County. I've done everything they got to do at the sheriff's office. I started out as a jailer and a dispatcher. Which neither one are real good jobs, by the way, and worked my way up, and I was investigator, assistant chief deputy when I left Gilmer County, served as chief deputy on an interim basis twice, and was twice offered the job permanently, but I had the good sense not to take it. It's a very rewarding job. Unfortunately, sometimes there's things happen, which are tragedies, and it takes a long time to get over them. Sometimes you never get over them. But I would recommend it to anybody. Even as dangerous as it is, it's a very rewarding thing. And I think we're here to help each other. I think it's one of our jobs is to help one another. And a lot of us are not smart enough to be doctors and pastors and things of that nature. So if I can be a cop, anybody can. So that's the what I chose to do. I've got notes here because my wife said I would goof up. It's very important to me that y'all understand before I get started. I'm going to be telling you a story here. It's all true. I may goof up on the dates a little because sometimes I get a little fuzzy on that, but It's a true thing that I lived through, and a bunch of people in this community remember what happened. But this story is not about me at all. It's about God. And I want y'all to remember that as we go through, because I'm going to say I done this, or I saw this, or this guy saw that, but that's not really what it's about. This was my partner, Brett Dickey. And if you were living here in 1996, you remember Brett Dickey was killed in the line of duty. He was a fine Christian man. People say nice things about people after they die. That's one thing I got to look forward to. People may possibly brag on me when I'm gone. But if you weren't no good when you die, that's sort of how people remember you. Everybody you talk to, anybody that knew Brett, knows he was just a good guy. I mean, he really was. He had a servant's heart. And this story, this is what it's about, is when he was killed, and other things that happened after that. Did I do that, or are you doing it? Oh, well, I'll just tell you. This picture of me and Brett when we were working together on night shift. Brett was, how do you say it, of average height, same as me. Everybody else is just tall. We took all kind of ridicule. We were the smallest people on the sheriff's office at the time. But they even called us a midget wrestling team, some of our true friends did. Anyway, we usually got the job done as best we could. But that's one of the few pictures of me and him together on the job. A lot of times we fished together, we hunted together, went to church together. And I've got some pictures of that. But I think this is possibly the only one of us on the job together. All right, go next, Mike. This is the fellow that on February 13th, 1996, we had a call from Forsyth County Sheriff's Office. And they said they believed that this fellow was here in Gilmer County. Somebody had brought him here to hide him out. He had about four aliases. His real name, that's his real name, Tommy Lamar Pickering. He has a rap sheet that I'm going to show you in a minute, just a partial part of it. It's long as your leg. So I'm going to tell you now what happened, what led up to it and led up to Brett being killed. A lady named Peggy Dawkins brought Tommy Pickering to this county. She was his girlfriend / adopted mother. And she brought him here, and he acquired a gun at one of the local gun shops with a girl that she bought it for him. She had met him the day before, and he'd give her this big line about how he had gang members out to get him. He needed something to protect himself with. And that he didn't have a driver's license, and without a driver's license in Georgia, you couldn't buy a gun, which we all know that's not true. You have to have some form of ID. But he was a convicted felon. Well, she fell for it, and she bought him a gun. Well, afterwards, he told her, after he got the gun, got some ammo, put the gun in his pocket, he told her the truth. He bragged about it. I just got out of prison just a few weeks ago. I'm wanted in Forsyth County. What he had done in Forsyth County, he was staying in a trailer park there, and there was two school teachers there, husband and wife. They were building a house. They had just moved there. They both got a job in that county, and school had already started, so they were working, and they didn't have anywhere to live. So they were renting a trailer while they were building a house. He lived in the trailer next door, and he ran out of beer. He'd been out of jail about two or three weeks, and he ran out of beer and ran out of marijuana, and he wanted somebody to take him to get some more beer. So he knocks on their door, and he tells them they don't know he even lives there. He tells them the story, something about his car store up, whatever. Well, they're good folks. They tell him, come on in, you know, and we'll give you a ride or whatever. Well, he drops a clue or two, and they see him fidgeting, and they realize he's got a gun, and got a knife at that time. He had a knife in his pocket. He opened it up, and anyway, the husband tried to get him to leave, whatever. Anyway, a little scuffle happens. He cuts this lady's nose almost off her face. She's 26, I think. This is going to be her first teaching job. Beautiful young lady. Cut her nose almost off, stabbed her husband in the back of the neck, and takes off. Well, he calls his girlfriend, who brings him to Gilmer County and hides him out, and then the gun thing happens and all that. She goes back, so he finds another girlfriend. All right, we get the call from Forsyth about these warrants. And for aggravated assault, which in Georgia, that's attempted murder. We don't have attempted murder per se in Georgia. It's called aggravated assault. So we find out that he's in the county and that he's possibly at the Owltown trailer park down the road. And we try to verify. We don't have a picture, so we're trying to verify. This girl that brought him the gun, after he bragged to her about it, she came up there and says, I think I've really goofed up. I'm sorry, but I bought somebody a gun. If he's telling me the truth now, he's a convicted felon, and I don't want to go to jail. I don't want somebody getting hurt. So we contact Forsyth, and we wait, and we wait, and we wait. And Brett and I are on duty that day. Nobody else is there except the chief and a couple of investigators. And, you know, if you're going to go out with someone who's got a gun, and by the way, he had told her, if you tell the law about this, I'll kill you, and I'll kill any law enforcement officer that comes to get me. All right, so we're trying to verify. We want to be sure this is the right person before we go out there pulling guns and possibly, you know, getting shot at or whatever, having to hurt him. Takes about 3 hours. Finally, his picture comes in. It was faxed. That's how we used to get them. You know, our computer was huge back then, and we got the got the facts and showed it to this young lady. It's him, you know, and she knows exactly where he is, so we got to go get him. Well, there wasn't no such thing as a SWAT team in Gilmer County back then. We had two deputies on the shift, and a lot of times if I was out or Brett was out on our shift, there was nobody to cover. If the chief wasn't there or another supervisor, wasn't anybody to cover for him. So you had this whole county by yourself. John remembers it. I mean, it was amazing. It's like Mayberry, only we had all these square miles of roads to patrol, all these calls, and sometimes one deputy, all the time, too. We start, normally what we would do back in the day was, we go over across the hall, talk to Stacy Nicholson, who's the sheriff now, he's the chief investigator. You know, hey, Stacy, here's what we got. We need some more warm bodies to go with us. And, of course, they go. You know, we were like family. We all stood up for each other. We'd call the city officers and ask them to go. Well, anyway, we assembled a team of seven people, seven officers. One of them was off duty, Kelly Towle. He worked for the city police department. He was an investigator at the time. And he was off duty. And I called down and I asked, if y'all got anybody can go? He said, no, we got one officer covering the city. He said, I'm getting off right now. He said, I've actually done a shift today on the road, which wasn't his job. He said, but I'll go. I'll go help you guys. That's just the way we did it, you know. So we all meet at the jail. We go down to Alltown Trotter Park, and he is, he's not there. We surround the place. He's not there. We find out he pulled the same trick. This time he used a gun, though. This gun, this young lady got him. He went to a fellow that lived in the trailer there and beat on the door, and he said, I need a ride. Can you give me a ride? He said, I can't right now. I got to go to work. He said, but I'll let you, if you need to use my phone, whatever. He said, no, I need a ride. He pulls the pistol out of his pocket. He says, you're going to give me a ride. Well, you know, what would you do? The guy don't have a weapon. He doesn't, you know, he gives him a ride. So we find out what kind of car it was, and we're heading, the last thing we knew was we had been looking for a ride. He was wanting to go out to 82. So we all go that direction. We meet the car coming back down here where the old water wheel used to be, past what we used to call the Drunkard Springs down here where the river runs by the road down here past Turnip Town. We find we see the car coming. Well, we do a felony stop on them. I mean, cross the cars up, get out with your guns drawn, you know, get on the ground, walk backwards, get on the ground, put your hands behind your back, the whole deal. The only person there is the driver of the car. He had done took Pickering where he wanted to go. Well, I noticed when he got out of the car, we hadn't had time to really scare him. I mean, it's kind of scary, these patrol cars coming in, you get out of the car and you got guns pointed at your head. But before we really got our guns out of the holster, he was getting out of the car. And before we could even say one word to him or give him a direction what to do, I noticed he had urinated all over himself. It was just, I mean, it was actually running. And I thought, something's up. I mean, that guy may still be in the car hiding. I mean, I didn't know what was going on. None of us did. The fact was, Pickering had scared him so bad that he couldn't control and he used the bathroom on himself. It wasn't us. He was glad to see us, even with guns drawn. He was saying, thank God. Thank God. I didn't pass the cop on the way out there. Well, of course not. Everyone we had was up at the jail getting ready to go find this guy. You know how it is. Never a cop around. You need one. So he tells us where he took him, excuse me, where he took him, and he agrees to ride in a patrol car and do a drive-by and show him exactly which trailer it is out on 282. We don't try to force him to. Just he said, I'll show you where he's at. He said, he's going to kill somebody. Well, little did we know, he was exactly right. So they do a drive-by. He shows them which mobile home it is on 282. And you know where the processors is up on the hill. It used to be Pine Mountain. It's Waldrop's now. There used to be some trailer. There's still a couple, but there's a little trailer park there. He was in the trailer, the first one facing the road. Well, we make a quick plan what we're going to do, and we all take off out there. And Eldridge Harper, a lot of y'all know Eldridge, he was with me in my patrol car, and we had a dash cam. They had just came out. That was the coolest thing. Now they got body cameras and everything else. But we thought, boy, this is something. And this thing was this big. I mean, it's like a big VCR camera. We were high-tech rednecks, though. So we're in the lead car. Andy Key was chief deputy. I think him and I think Stacy Nicholson were in the same car. I'm not sure, but I think they were. And then there was another car. And then Kelly Powell was talking about, he drove his pickup truck. He was off duty, so he just drove his truck. We, you know, go up on the porch and we get, I start knocking on the door. And this is a kind of an interesting point, too. I had loaned my bulletproof vest, which I had bought because we didn't have them back then. If you wanted one, you bought one when State Patrol would auction them off. After their expiration date goes out, that's when we'd get them. And I had bought one for $50, and I had, but I had loaned it to the guy that searched civil papers because he didn't have anything. And the week prior to that, a guy just serving the civil paper on a late movie, you know, back when people used to rent movies, in Florida, had walked up on the porch. Well, it was a meth house, and he didn't know it. And they thought he knew. They opened the door and cut him in half with a shotgun. And he was in his hand. He had a warrant for, I think it was a $15 movie, and that's what he died for. And he was supposed to retire in 2 months, I think. Well, Billy comes to me. I did some of the purchasing back then, and he said, "Can you get me a vest? I'd just like to have a vest. You know, I don't want to get killed if I can help it." So I said, "No, but I never wear mine. I keep it handy, you know. I'd keep it under the seat." And I say handy, I don't know how many times I've got out on something and realized all of a sudden I need my vest and that thing's hung under the seat. You can't get it out. So I told Billy, I said, you can wear mine. And, cause I was going to be off that, for 2 or 3 more days. I said, I'll just get it back and we'll just start swapping, you know. Well, I didn't have my vest, so Andy Key, a lot of you know Andy, he was chief deputy. He didn't wear his vest, hardly ever either. And he said, "I want you to go to the front door." And he said, "I want you to wear my vest." I said, "I'm going to wear your vest." I said, "Hey, I don't need it." And, you know, I was thinking, boy, I don't want nothing happening to him and me wearing his vest. Well, that's the only order the man ever gave me in all the years I worked with him. He said, "Put my vest on and wear it." He said, "I'll stay in the background." Well, Andy, back then, he didn't stay in the background. I knew he'd be right out front doing whatever, but he gave me an order, so I followed it, put it on. That becomes significant a little later on. We surround the place. I go to the front door, and I knock, and a guy comes to the door, and he has a baby, 2 years old, 3, you know, a toddler in his arms. And I said, "I'm looking for Tommy Lamar Pickering, and is he here?" And he says, "No, I don't know him." And he's going like this the whole time. He says, "No, I don't know him. I've never heard of him. He's not here." And he's doing his head this way. I said, "Okay." I said, "Well, can you come outside and where I can talk to you?" And I said, "And bring that child out with you." He said, "No, I better stay in here." He's doing his head like this. And the whole time he's trying to get past me and get out on the porch. So he's scared. And he came out and I can't remember who was there, and I said, "Hey, put them in my car, you know, in the back seat, because we got the bulletproof shield back there, you know, just in case bullets, whatever." Well, they took them out, got in the back seat of the car, and there's another guy in there, but it's not who we're looking for. Well, he won't come outside. Well, at this point, we can't go in. We got somebody between us, because we can sleep on back, you know, start down the trailer. We got somebody between us, you know, that's going to be in the line of fire if shots are fired. So I'm still trying to talk him out. He won't come out. Find out he's got warrants on him. Just some little petty thing. Finally, we get him out and have to take him down on the porch and cuff him. And they get him, put him in the back of another car. Well, the guy that had the baby, he's done told everything. He said, "I don't know this guy. I was visiting the guy y'all just brought out. And I'm scared death, and I didn't want this baby getting hurt and all this stuff." So he tells us where he is. He's in the back bedroom. He's got a gun and all this stuff. Well, like I said, we didn't have a SWAT team, so you can't just go charging in. Half of us don't have vests, you know. And he's familiar with the residence he's in. We're not. So I start doing my spiel, you know, "You're surrounded. There's no point. There's no point in staying in there. Come on out. You're not, you know, you're not going to get away. There's no way you're going to get away from here." We've got, you know, like I said, we've got these 7 officers. And I think back on it now, one of the officers I remember, I didn't know this because I'm in the front, but around back, they don't have any cover. They got a post in the ground, like a corner post on the fence. One of them's behind it, you know, and they're like me. They're hanging out everywhere. You know, it's dangerous. So then another officer who I thought was probably one of the smartest officers we had, is taking cover down on his knee over a propane tank. So I kind of changed my opinion about him, but I'm around front screaming at this guy. Well, he started engaging me then. He's cussing me, calling me all kinds of stuff. But that's good. We know exactly where he's at because I can hear him. And the more he talks bad to me, the more I tell him, you're just wasting your breath, you know. And all this is on video. Well, the chief, Andy, comes around to me and he says, I have a pepper spray grenade in the trunk of my car. Can you keep him busy? He said, the back door's cracked open. I'll chunk that thing back there in the bedroom with him. He'll come out of there. I said, yes, sir. I mean, he's cussing me for everything he's worth in. I thought, it ain't going to be no problem keeping him busy. So he gets it out of his car, goes back around there. And I don't know where everybody is around back because I'm on the front porch. Well, Kelly Powell, the guy I was talking about, he is on the carport. And the trailer is this way, the front door's here. That's where I am on a little porch. Pickard's in this far end of the trailer. And Kelly is under a carport right here on this end, taking cover behind the car that's parked there. Well, Andy is telling Kelly what he's doing, and Kelly's relaying it to me. So there's a little delay there. About the time Kelly says, it's in. Andy had threw the pepper spray grenade in there. About the time he says that, I hear the window breaking. I mean, it was kind of delayed. He was already in there and it was getting, because them things are terrible. Well, I think it was Stacy Nicholson said, Sanford, get out of there. You can hear this on the video. Because we thought he's knocking the glass out to shoot, because he could lean out, you know, and two of us are right there. So on the video, in one of my triumphant moments, you see a chubby guy jump over the rail of the porch, and I land on my hands and knees down, because I'm getting ready to take cover in midair, because this guy's right there, and he's got a gun, you know. So I get down, and I go around to the corner, and by the time I get to the edge of this porch here, and the trailer, I think, was 65 feet long, we're probably a good 55 feet away. I've got snot just pouring. Tears coming out. Kelly, I looked over at him. His face was red. He looked like you sprayed him in the face with pepper spray. And I said, how's he staying in there? Because I don't know. He said, I can't take it. You know, he's just snorting and snorting. And we backed up a little bit. Well, in just a minute, I'm still yelling at him. On the film, you can see a fire back there. He set the curtains on fire. He's going to burn the trailer down. And I think he thought that maybe when all this is going on, he could run, maybe get away. But you see the fire, and of course he's screaming and cussing and all that. And just all of a sudden, I'm sitting down behind these steps, you know, with my gun pointed that way. Kelly's right beside me. The other guys are in the back expecting him to run out the back. He comes out this little window, head first, on the ground. And he no sooner hits the ground than it's like he's got turbo. He takes off just flying out through the yard there. Well, I holster my gun, take off. Well, that's the last thing you see is all of us chasing him, and then we're out of range. You know, the video can't pick us up. What happened was Donnie Daves, who was an officer, Carol that goes here, that was her husband. He was fast as a rabbit. He took off. You can see him on the camera. He looks like lightning. He goes out through there after him. Well, he gets to him at the edge of the road on 282, and this is about probably at that time 7:38, 7:40, something like that. People are coming home at work in the carpet mills in Chatsworth and Dalton, and nobody runs the speed limit on 282. And I mean, he's blinded. He runs, jumps out, and falls that kind of out in the road, jumps up and runs, and Donnie just, you know, adrenaline pumping, he just goes right after him. Cars lock it down, slide sideways. They come so close to getting ran over. It was almost finished right there. Donnie, as we come up to the thing, Brett has caught up to me. And that sounds like I could run fast, but I couldn't. I was way ahead of him. He was in the backyard. But he had done caught up, and I stopped. And when But in as partners, you know, I don't know. It's just a thing you develop. I've thrown my arm out to catch Brett because his car coming. He threw his out to catch me. And we're standing there like this. As soon as the cars go by, we take off. Some of the other guys are coming that were further in the backyard. They're running behind us. We can hear them. I see Donnie tackling. He tackles him, gets him down on the ground. And Pickering is climbing and kind of got his face in his belly, trying to climb up. And Donnie gets him down on the ground, and they're scuffling. And this, and he's a pretty good-sized guy. He's about, I think he's about 6'1". Donnie's just, there was like this on the ground. Legs, hands, everything. And, you know, your training kicks in, and we go up, and Brett, I was going to tell you, you know, as partners, they train you when you go in somewhere. Like if we had to come in this building, when I get in here, I don't worry about me. I look out for my partner. I've got his back, you know. And he, and I know he does me. And somehow that develops a higher sense of security for you. You don't, you're not looking at him. Your partner's got his, you know, he's taking care of you. Well, and I guess that's where the throwing our arms thing went out. You know, it was just being partners. Well, we get to the thing, just like so many times before, we don't have to say, don't have to vocalize what we're going to do. I just seen Brett start kneeling. That means he's going to get down and get his legs under control. So my training says, put your knee on his neck, get the upper part of his body under control. Then Donnie can get his arms and cuff him, because that's what he's trying to do. And I remember, and this is kind of fuzzy, but I remember as Brett was getting down like this to get on his legs, I was bending down to get on his neck with my knee. I heard gun. That's the universal thing. You know, you say gun, it goes to a different level then. Training kicks in. I remember seeing Brett raising up. What you do, you take two steps back, draw your weapon, and you find a target. You try to acquire a shot. That's what I'm doing. I'm backing up. I draw my gun. And the last thing I remember seeing was Brett raising up. And it happens like this. Then, boom. Well, we knew that he had bought a 25 automatic. This was a 25 automatic. It was a 40 caliber, and it makes a very distinct sound. And some officers say they shoot their own weapon so much, they can recognize their gun in a crowd if somebody shoots it. Well, I heard the first shot. Well, I just, you know, it's like this. So they're 3 feet from me, and Donnie's all over his back, arms going like this, legs. There's no shot. And to be successful in a combat situation, a shooting, you need cover or a shot, preferably both. We had neither. We're in a highway. And there's no shot because they're fighting. So I'm like this. I heard the first shot. I pulled my gun up, and I was about from here to his boot right there. And I had just a little spot on the side of his head right there. And all this stuff starts running through your mind. You know, you're going to court. You're about to take a life. You've got to live with this the rest of your life. All this stuff, it really does. It runs through your mind all at once. And anybody that's a veteran has been in that kind of situation, you realize. I mean, it's all going through your head at one time. And the whole time, you're squeezing the trigger. Because regardless of what you have to do, you've got to stop this threat. So Donnie flips right over there. I just bring my gun up. I never fired. Had no shot. I hear the gun scraping on the pavement. I look down while I'm trying to figure out what to do. Now, and keep in mind, I'm not the only one there. There is 6 more officers there. So they're all doing their thing, trying to do the same thing I am. Well, I'm closest right here to his side. I see Donnie's got his arm, and this gun is scraping on my asphalt. I hear it. I look down, and here comes this gun. Well, with no cover and no shot, my next bright idea was, I'm going to stomp this gun. He can shoot till he empties the clip, but he can't hit nobody. Seemed like a pretty good plan. Except I raised this leg, and by the time I started to come down, he shot again and hit me right above the ankle right here at about 3 feet. Well, as I'm going down, as we're trained to do, I say, I'm hit. Don't even remember. I remember it afterwards. Remember, that's what they train you to do, you know. That tells the other officers, we got an officer shot right here. It's time to kill this guy. You know, no more second chances, whatever. He's dead. And I want to tell you this. This is part of my political incorrectness because it becomes important a little later. The police academy when you go, you know, you get a crash course in law, criminal law, some civil law. But they also teach you, you know, how to handle the weapon and all that kind of stuff. And they tell you the politically correct thing is, like, if you're in a court situation or whatever, we don't draw our gun unless we're ready to shoot because there's a threat. And you don't draw your gun to shoot, to kill. That's a no-no. You don't say that. You don't draw your gun to wound somebody. But when you draw your gun, you draw it to stop the threat. That's what you're taught to do, stop the threat. All right? To stop the threat, you shoot for the center of body mass. Okay? So the politically incorrect thing to say is, they teach us to kill people if you have to. If it gets that bad, heaven forbid, you got to shoot somebody, you shoot right there. Okay? But we're not shooting to kill now. That's what, when you go to court, you say, no, I shot to stop the threat. And they also teach that if you lose your weapon or you don't have a chance to get your weapon out or something happens, heaven forbid, they teach you to stop the threat with your hands or whatever you can get a hold of, whether it be an ink pen, whatever. They teach you to do that. They teach you to kill people with your bare hands. You don't want to, and you hope you never have to, but they teach you these things. And like I said, that'll be significant here in a few minutes. But I get hit. I say, I'm hit. I hear pow, 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 pow. And I thought, they got him, and I hit the ground. Well, I think, I don't know if I passed out. I don't know what happened. But I'm on this side of 282. It's roughly 24 feet across. I rolled in an uphill fashion across the road into a ditch where two of those bullets that Pickering shot, he shot 10 times at people 2 and 3 feet away from him. Two of those bullets, had I not rolled into this ditch, would have hit me in the head. So I don't think it was me rolling. I think I was rolled out of the road. And that may be a miracle all in itself. I don't know. But anyway, he shot 10 times. One of the shots got so close to one officer, it powder burned him. Powder burned his face and his neck. Those are some of the most brave people I've ever knew, those officers. It's amazing. I'm laying over here in the ditch bleeding. They're all doing their job, you know. I mean, I didn't have a lot of choice about it, but I have a lot of respect for them because they return fire. Eldridge, and this is one of those things I'm not trying to... I don't know. I can't remember. But Eldridge shot once, and Stacy Nicholson shot twice, or the other way around. But anyway, they shot, but Donnie's still fighting with him. And so they're like this, and they shoot, and they sort of overcompensate because they don't want to hit Donnie, and they get right next to his head, just right next to it. But it's so close that after about 3 shots, he says, you know, they're going to kill me, and he lets go of the gun after firing 10 times just into the night, you know, with officers all around him. That's probably another miracle that there were not more officers hit. Well, as I kind of got my bearings about me in the ditch, I remember my leg. People say, well, I've heard when you get shot, it doesn't hurt. Don't buy that. I'm telling you, it's awful. A .40 caliber, you know, it goes in the size of the bullet, you know, but it comes out. It looks like hamburger meat when it comes out. And I could feel this burning down here. It was awful. I've never seen anything like it. So I reach down, and I feel that. And I can feel something bad wrong. I can't really tell because I got a big, tall boot on. But it's just hot burning, and it burns all the way up my leg, all the way to my chest. Well, the first thing I think of, I got a vest on. So I probably broke some ribs. I feel around here and feel under the vest, and the only blood I have, I use this hand, the only blood I have is on my right hand, which I check my leg with. Okay, I realize I'm shot in the leg, and whatever this is, adrenaline, whatever, I'm not shot in the chest. Well, about that time, I look, and I see across the road, Pickering's still struggling. He's still fighting, trying to get him cuffed. And these are some big old boys now. I got a couple of them on a picture coming up, I'll show you. They can't get him under control. Come to find out, he's all doped up. You know, he's on all kinds of stuff. I remember Kelly Powell coming down with I think it's AR-15 across the top of his head. And Kelly was worried when we were interviewed by the GBI later. He was scared. He said, you know, this guy, we got one cuff on him, and all these guys here, and I busted his head, but I didn't know what else to do. He was afraid he was going to get in trouble for it. And the GBI agent said, you could have killed him. You could have shot him. You had every legal right to shoot him because he's trying to get away and he just committed a murder in your presence. And that's the next thing. This is the hard part. This is the point of this part of the story. The first shot, little did I know, hit my partner. And as Brett lay that, he was laying in the road. Now I remember Andy Key, who was the chief deputy, was hollering, hang in there, Brett. See, we done had an ambulance on standby. We had a call and we thought somebody was going to be dangerous, might have to hurt them or them hurt us. Well, we keep an ambulance on standby. And I was thinking to myself, and I heard somebody say he's hit in the chest. Well, we all joked, Brett, he'd take a shower with his bulletproof vest on. I mean, he was religious about that thing. The rest of us, not so much. But of all the people, I thought, well, he'll be fine. You know, he's got the wind knocked out of him. I can't see him. I can see people around him. The ambulance comes up, and I can hear Andy saying, hang in there, Brett, hang in there, buddy, whatever. Well, here's the other part of the story that really hits home. Brett was Andy's son-in-law. That he is Andy's daughter's husband and the father of Andy's grandson, who is 9 months old at this time. So not only is this a co-worker who Andy's his supervisor, which is bad enough, this is his son, this is family laying here. It ain't nothing he can do. Well, as I said, Brett wore his vest, and I thought, well, he'll be fine. You know, he's got the wind knocked out of him. He's like an old stubborn mule. You couldn't kill him. So I can hear in Andy's voice, though, as the ambulance, the MPs get there, I can hear the urgency. I mean, it's tough. I can still hear it. And I knew something's bad wrong. But I keep telling myself, he's got his vest on. He's got his vest on. Well, as they're working with Brett, I hear one of the EMTs say, it's got inside his vest. So, I remember, it's vague, but Kelly Powell came over to me and said, what can I do? And I said, do you have a trouser belt on? And he said, yes. I said, tie it around my leg, above my knee, as tight as you can, and then go help Brett. So he took his belt off. And he just looped, he's about this big around, he just looped it around my leg, tied it off. And Stacy, the sheriff, who was an investigator, all of them except Andy. Andy hung in there with Brett, but I heard him tell him, you know, don't leave Mark in that ditch by himself. Get over there with him, you know. Well, they'd come to me, and here I am. My sole thing every day is to, well, keep the peace, but I'm responsible for my partner. He's responsible for me. I failed him. I mean, I have failed him. He's laying over there in the road, and I know he's hit bad, and I failed him. And at that point, I tried to crawl. I could not crawl. I couldn't get myself to pull. I was going to go try to get over to him in the road there, and I couldn't do it. So when they came around to see what they could do for me or try to do whatever, I would yell at them, go help Brett. Leave me alone. I'm fine, you know. And I guess that was my last-ditch effort to try to be a partner, you know. Well, they get me to the ambulance, and I remember they had called another ambulance, of course, and they get me in the ambulance, and I remember getting the doors, you know, holding on. I wouldn't go in. I said, I'm not going to. Y'all take Brett. And the ambulance driver said, Brett's almost to the hospital. They done got him. He's on his way. So they got me on in there, and he said, this may be a flesh wound. I said, I'm pretty sure it's not, you know. And I said, it's just awful. It just hurts terrible. And then I'd ask about Brett, you know, he's at the hospital. Well, I remember him pulling my boot loose and going to take it off. And all of a sudden it felt like water pouring on my whole leg. And he tied it back up, done the strings like that and tied it really tight again. And I remember looking at him, and his face was white. And he said, okay. He said, you're going to be fine. He said, we'll be in the hospital in a few minutes. What can I do to help you? I said, back then they had those old bag phones, you know, in the ambulance. And I said, I need to use the telephone to call my wife. And he said, well, you tell me the number, and I'll call her for you. I said, no, let me call her, because if you call her and tell her that I've been hurt or whatever, she's not going to believe I'm okay. But if she hears me, she'll know I am. So he dials the number, gives me the phone, and I told her, you know, they say it's a call you never want to get. Believe me, it's a call you don't ever want to make either. But I told her, I said, we got in a scrape out here, and I said, me and Brett both have been shot. I'm fine. I said, I'm going to be fine. I'm hitting the leg. I'm going to be fine. I said, I'll be up and going by tomorrow or something like that. And just dead silence. She don't say anything. And then I told her, I said, or she said, are you sure you're okay? And I said, yeah, I'm okay. Take my daughter's name, Gina. I said, take Gina to your mom's and come to the hospital. This is tough, sorry. And I told her, I said, Brett's bad. Start praying for him and don't quit till you get there. She hung phone. Well, we get to the hospital. And fortunately, I never saw Brett. I saw his feet on the table. And Jeff Ellington, some of y'all know Jeff. He was a deputy. Actually, he worked for the police department then, but he's also an EMT. I remember he was straddled of Brett, and I just seen it as they took me back to the back room. And he's just doing this, just on and on and on. And I thought, you know, Jeff's good at his job. Brett's going to be fine. Well, come to find out what had happened was the little part about me, my right leg is right above the ankle, shot me basically point blank range, 40 caliber. It expanded when it hit. I lost 6 inches of bone in my right leg, both bones, the tibia and the tibia. So that's why, I had nothing to hold me up. That's why I hit the ground. Brett, as he was raising up to go for his weapon, he was bent over. Pickering shot, and come to find out what he was doing, and he's pepper sprayed. All he knows is a bunch of officers there. He was trying to get the gun around to shoot Donnie. Donnie was on his back. He didn't know where we were. He couldn't see us. He knew Donnie was there, and he was trying to hit Donnie, but when he come around with a gun, old Brett was raising up. The bullet went right above the top of his vest. And those vests are made to keep the bullets out. But if one gets in there, it can't get out. And it's like putting a rock in that cup and shaking it. It hit the front, the back, the front, the back. Brett didn't stand a chance. He was dead when he hit the highway. Jeff, to his credit, kept a heartbeat all the way to the hospital. They said he was just exhausted. He worked on him so much. But it was nothing to be done. Now, this is important. Leading up to this point of this happening, Brett's son had been born. He was 9 months old. Brett was always a good guy, but Brett started getting more involved in church. And he was, he sung in the choir. He taught Sunday school. And he worried us to death, every one of us, even inmates, inviting us to go to church all the time. Hey, Brett, how was the weekend? It was good. You going to church next Sunday? You went fishing. How was the old fishing trip? Was good. You coming to church next Sunday? It's on and on and on. And so he kept on. I finally went just to get him to shut up. I enjoyed it. We went 2 or 3 Sundays prior to this. And he'd been after his best friend, Jake Davenport, who's I think he's chief investigator in Fannin County. Now, he was a detention officer at the time. He'd been trying to get him to go to church. He never would go. That's significant, too. Anyway, Brett died, and all of our lives changed. Andy, bless his heart, he's a father-in-law. He came to me as they're taking me to intensive care and says, Mark, what can I do? What can I do for you? He just lost his son-in-law, but he's still being the chief. The chief whose vest I was wearing. What if I'd got shot up here? What if he got shot not wearing his vest because I had his vest on? Can't tell you the amount of respect I have for him. He says, what can I do for you? And I said, nothing, I'm good, go be with Brett. He said, there's nothing. I didn't know Brett had died. He said, there's nothing we can do for Brett but pray. I said, then go do that. He said, are you sure? I said, yes, sir. And I remember him squeezing my hand, and he went on. Well, I don't remember much from then on. They had me doped up and everything. Well, I went to Erlanger the next day. They sent the helicopter for Brett. He was dead when they got there. So I went to Erlanger the next day and immediately went into surgery. Had 3 surgeries in 3 days. And didn't get to go to Brett's funeral. I was having another surgery. And, Mike, if you'll click this, I want to show. The left-hand side is the day after the first surgery. They put that fixator in. Those are 4-inch long, 6-inch long. There's 3 inches in and about 3 inches out of my leg. the bone actually, see if I can make this thing work. Look at there. From about right here to here, right above the ankle joint to here, was no good. So they had to take it out. So that's when I said I lost 6 inches of bone. It shot this much out, but they had to go plumb up here to take it out. Brett's funeral, it was something. Go forward, Matt, please. There was 382 cars in the funeral procession. 293 law enforcement, 89 civilians. I didn't get to go, like I said, but they took pictures and stuff of it for me. And Stacy Nicholson told me that when the last cars were pulling on the ramp down here at 52, the lead patrol car was turning left at McDonald's in Blue Ridge. All right, go forward in another one. Every year we go up to Brett's grave. Every year. This is several years ago. This is the 20th anniversary, which February 13th will be 22 years, so that's 2 years ago. That's R.T. Henry, that good-looking guy's me, the one that looks like a mafia guy, that's Kelly Powell, and that's the sheriff, that's Stacy Nicholson. That was the 20th anniversary. They all went up there then. Now, here's the amazing part of this part of the story. This is the first healing. I had all these surgeries, including the bone graft, skin graft. The bone graft, after 4 months, should have been pretty much healed. I go to the doctor. Every time I go, it's not healing. It's not healing. We're going to have to do it again. I'd been to Emory for a second opinion, and second opinions aren't always the best. They wanted to amputate my leg. I headed back to Erlanger with a quickness. I got away from those doctors. There's two of them that said that 6-inch bone graft never worked. They'd have to amputate. Well, we go back to Erlanger, and anyway, the doctor does it, and he takes the bone out of my pelvis and hip, puts it down there. It doesn't work. So I'm thinking, they're going to cut my leg off. Well, in the meanwhile, the doctor says, I'm going to give you another month, and I want you to come back. If there's no signs of healing, then we're going to take another step. All right. Does anybody remember, John probably does, Vivian Garland? We called her Granny. Hilda Willis, that was a nurse for years, it was her mother. She went to this little church over on Big Creek, Big Creek Community Church, and I used to go there some when I was a kid. Well, she'd been calling me relentlessly. Hey, while you're laid up, you know, you're always too busy before. While you're laid up, come to church. Well, I mean, how many excuses can you come up with? I'm not really doing anything except laying there, hoping this bone will heal. She said, there's been lots of healings take place in this church. And she says, I believe we have a healing over here for you. I think God is going to heal your leg. I said, well, I don't know about that. Let me see. You know, I'm still, no. Sounds good, but I'm very reluctant. I finally go. And I'm all down and out. And I go, I had been to the doctor 3 days before. And that's when he told me all these things. Get over there, whenever they have their service, nice service, everything, beautiful singing. The pastor says, can we pray for you? Can we assemble and pray for you, pray for healing for your leg? I mean, even if, of course it's fine, but even if you don't, I'm thinking, boy, they put you on the spot here. The whole church is here, you know, and he's asking you, what are you going to say? No, I'd rather not. I said, absolutely, yeah. So he comes over, and I'm scared. I'm thinking it's going to be one of them forehead-hitting deals like you see on TV, you know. He comes over there. He lays his hand on my leg right there, right between that spot right there. He lays his hand on there. And the rest of the church gather around, and they very quietly and softly pray. Well, in a second, it's over. He pats me on the shoulder. Brother, you're healed. You can walk out of here. Now, I'd like to tell you, I jumped up and hollered hallelujah and ran around the church. I didn't. There was no lightning bolts. Nothing felt any different. I didn't hear any booming voice from heaven. I mean, I felt just like I did before they came up there and done that. And I said, thank you so much, and I appreciate what y'all have done. But I believe I'm going to wait and let the doctor tell me, you know, before I start walking on this thing. He said, absolutely, I don't blame you. I did the same thing, I believe. He said, but remember this day, you're healed. thank you very much, shake everybody's hand, hug everybody, we go home. Well, get home, my father's there, and of course my wife and daughter was with me, and I get out of the car, and I've always been a little stubborn, and there was just some vegetables out there that I think my dad had planted, so I'd have something to look at or whatever. And there was a cucumber there, and I'm not that crazy about cucumbers. I made my mind up, I'm going to get that cucumber out of the garden. My wife's going to tell me, don't go out in that garden, you'll fall. And I said, no, I'll be fine. No, don't go. Let me get it. No, I'll go. Well, I'm on these crutches, you know. Here I go, just to get it. Just for no other reason, be stubborn, mule-headed, you know. Well, I get out there and I fall, first thing. Come straight down on this leg, which by this time now is in a cast. But I come straight down on it. And you talk about hurting. It's like being shot all over again. I just roll on the ground. Scares everybody to death. My daddy comes running over there and just jerks me up like a rag doll. And helps me in the house, and I mean, tears, it hurts so bad. And a little while, it quit. Quit hurting. I said, well, good. My wife said, oh, you need to go see your surgeon. She said, you've got to go there. You've messed something up. She said, if you don't feel anything, something's dead down there. You're going to have to get it fixed. So she calls, and they get me lined up. It was hard to get an appointment. Anyway, got me one for 2 days later. So this puts us at 5 or 6 days. I'm not real clear from the time that I was there before. I go in, doctor comes in, his usual great bedside manner, and says, boy, you've really goofed it up, I'm sure. You know, thanks a lot. All this beautiful work I've done, you've messed it all up. He said, let's get this cast off and x-ray it and see what happens. Well, anyway, I sat down there, and he cut the cast off, and I'm just expecting my leg to do like it did before, you know, when they finally did take my boot off at the hospital, and my foot just kind of fell upside down, with bone sticking out and all kind of nice stuff, and I'm sitting there just kind of looking like that, you know, and nothing happens. My leg just laying there. And he says, wiggle your toes, and I do, and they take me for x-ray. He comes back in, he's shaking his head. I said, oh, man, I've done it now. You know, pops the x-rays up on the thing. He said, well, I don't know what to tell you. I want you to go home and start walking. 5, maybe 6 days later, I'm not sure, from when he told me, when it looked like, I guess this on the right was right before. And if you can see right in here, this bone is not hooked together. This is some bullet fragments still in there, like those over there. But this bone is not hooked together. It's not hooked together down here. He told me at that point, he said, if we don't do something, it'll take 6 to 8 more months. He said, we need to get this next surgery done. If that don't work, amputation is really the only thing you got left. But let's try this again. That's what he told me before. 5, maybe 6 days later, he says, go home and walk. Now, I told the preacher, I said, I appreciate it, but I'm going to let my doctor tell me to walk. Well, hadn't been for that little old cucumber out there, and me being so aggravating, hot, you know, hard-headed, I wouldn't have been up there at the doctor's office for a month. I wouldn't have knew a few days later that over that little church, God Almighty healed my leg. He did it. I mean, there's no doubt. The doctor told me. He said, every once in a while, something like this happens. He said, boy, I'd like to take credit for it. But he said, it's not my work. And I said, well, what happened? He said, you tell me. He said, I think you know what happened. You tell me. Well, I told him about that. He said, there you go. See, one reason I like this doctor the best, the two down at Emory, one of them even went so far as to say, I hope the best for you, wish the best for you, but it would take a miracle. And she said, I've been in business several years, and I've never seen any miracles. This doctor up here, when I first met him, he said, if you'll put just a little dab of faith in me and a whole bunch in the good Lord, we'll fix your leg. So that was my doctor. I said, he's the one, you know. So anyway, I made him, now to show you how much faith I had, I made him tell me 3 times, go home and walk. 3 times. Well, I went home, and my walking started out like this. You know, I mean, you just can't get in the rhythm. So anyway, I was healed. And you hear about these things, and you're a little skeptical, whatever. And I thought, you know, all the healing's like on TV, you know, it's a big thing. But the trick to this thing is, I've thought about this a lot over the years, is God don't have anything to prove to us. It's all been done. We know He's God. What's He got to prove to us? He doesn't need a big show or anything. This healing was very soft and very quiet. By a loving God who doesn't have to prove anything to anybody. But it happened. All right, now this next part, and I'm going to speed up because I know everybody's got stuff to do. This is probably the most important part to me. I hated Tommy Lamar Pickering. I hated him. And you know, we say hate all the time. We say, well, I don't hate such and such, but yeah, I really don't like their ways. I hate their ways or whatever. You hear people say, well, such and such is sick. I hate to hear that. Hate is just part of what we say. But let me tell you about hate, real hate. Real hate to me, I guess it's different for everybody, was I told you about them teaching us to, if you had to kill with your hands. I've had people say to me before, and when I used to work with Mr. Timms, I had several people at school say, well, wouldn't you like to get that fellow alone in the room, just you and him, lock the door, and have your Glock with you? And as appealing as that sounds when you hate somebody, that ain't enough. Real hate is where you don't want a gun. You want to feel it. You want to feel the life slipping from their body. I dreamed about it. I won't say I fantasized about it. I dreamed about it. I mean, I would have nightmares. I would wake up in a cold sweat screaming. My wife will vouch for that. Because in my dreams, I could feel the life slipping from his body, and it was a satisfying, gratifying feeling. That's hate, and it's a poison. And for 20 years or so, I hated him. And we'd go to the grave every year. We'd visit with Brett's parents. I'd go on about my life, raising kids, doing whatever. And the whole time I'm filled with this hate. Not for what he'd done for me, you know, shooting me. I figure, you know, any of us who play football, you're going to get a bloody nose eventually. You know, we all in law enforcement, you're going to get your bag tore off your shirt. You're going to get spit on. You're going to get your nose busted. I've got scars on my ears from being hit. Everything else. That just happens. Now, granted, getting shot is one of those real bad bloody noses. You know, you don't want it, but you know it can happen. I got over that. He slowed me down for a little while. He killed my dear friend. He maliciously killed him. He had a 9-month-old son, a wife. He's as good a person as I knew, and he killed him senselessly. There was no point. He couldn't get away. There was no point in that. And I hated him for it. I'm talking about a real hate. When you imagine choking somebody to death after gouging their eyes out with your fingers, you hate them. And it just eats you up and it consumes you. Well, I looking back, I realized I was bitter with my family, with my friends. I had a chip on both shoulders. And I didn't even realize it. It was back in here somewhere, you know, filed away. But I hated him. Sometimes I'd wake up thinking about killing him. And I've told Mike that I've been conflicted a lot over the years. On one hand, I say, you know, I need to forgive him. On the other hand, I'm thinking I could shoot him like shooting a tin can off a fence post. But it just consumed me. And it's addictive. Hate is. I mean, you'll find new ways. It's like drinking. You know, you go from beer to whiskey because the beer is not strong enough anymore. Well, this hate, you hate him on this level, and you find another level to hate him on. And I hated him. And somebody said, well, he'll never get parole. And I thought, well, you know, I wish he would. I'd like to be the one, you know. And it's not just me now. Some of these other guys out there are the same thing. This was our dear friend, a good person, which this man, Mike, can you flip back to his picture? He just looks mean, don't he? You know what we're doing? We're judging him. And I judged him for about 20 years. He looks evil. Can you flip forward? Do you find his rap sheet? Part of it. It's hard to read. Over here on the left is the Gilmer County charges from the shooting. Over here is Forsyth County, attempted armed robbery, possession of a firearm by convicted felon, burglary. This is the important part here. He was incarcerated. Man, that gets blurry. He was incarcerated in October of 93. If you add this up, he got 25 years for armed robbery where he shot at law enforcement officers. Didn't hit him, maybe shot at him. He had collectively 25 years, and he served, after diagnostics, he served about 18 months, and the parole board said, hey, he's good, let him go. I hated the parole board because they turned him loose. Then he comes up here, and you go to the Gilmer County one over here. Possession of firearm by convicted felon, that's an old story. Possession of firearm during a crime, old story. Then you get on down here, it says murder. Aggravated assault on peace officers. He got life without parole, and Judge Milam said in court, and I knew Judge Milam a long time, Never heard him say anything like this. He said, "It is with satisfaction that I give you the maximum to go along with this life sentence without parole of 100 years. So he got life plus 100 years. And the judge said he was tickled to give it to him. That's how bad. This guy would come to hearings singing, "I shot the sheriff." He would come to hearings, and when I was coming in on my crutches with my little girl beside me going into these hearings, he would laugh and say something to her about, "Hey, your daddy can't walk." You know, I mean, he just continuously said, telling the guards, "I wish you'd been there, I'd have killed you." He said to one of the guards, the guard told him, he said, "You better behave, you got the shock belt on him, you know." He told the guard, he said, "I don't care about that." He said, "Well, the judge will give you extra time, you better watch it." He said, "Judge Milam don't fool around." He didn't. He said, "I wish he'd have been out there, I'd have killed him if I could have." The guard recorded it. I mean, he come in and testified to it. So it all, had he not been out on parole, this is stuff over here couldn't have happened. All right, go back to his picture, Mike, if you don't care. Now, for 20 years I looked at his picture. I flipped through the newspaper every so often. He came up for a hearing. He was having hearings for an appeal, I guess, 5, 6, 7 years after this happened. The whole time I'm looking at him and I'm saying, you know, what an evil-looking, whatever you can think of is what I was thinking. And then I'd get up to go to a play for my daughter at school. I was hating the whole time. It just was part of me. Well, it started consuming me, and I was having these nightmares and all this kind of problem, and I prayed about it, and I prayed about, Lord, help me, you know, what? Give me a sign. What am I going to do? Well, go back to the picture at the grave, Mark. The 20th anniversary, it's usually me and Kelly. We've never missed a time in 21 years. This will be 22. I didn't get to go to the funeral, but I've not missed the anniversary of Brett dying and going to his grave and putting flowers on ever. And Kelly hadn't either. These other guys go when they can. That day I left there, and I'd been up the night before, and, you know, you have these little dreams and you feel terrible and all this, and you just hate him. You know, you just want to kill him. I came home that night, and I think Michelle was gone somewhere, and I got the Bible out, started reading through it, and I closed the Bible up and I prayed. I said, "Lord, I've prayed for you to help me. Give me an answer. I don't know what to do." Well, the answer was staring at me the whole time, and I didn't realize it. I kept praying for me. It was me, you know, and I prayed for these other officers. And I'd like to tell you that I just opened the Bible up, and there it was, like you hear people say. It didn't happen that way. And all of a sudden, I read it. I was just flipping through the Bible, and all of a sudden, if I start crying, I apologize. I'm the biggest baby you ever met. The Matthew 5:44. I've read it, I don't know how many times over the years, but I read it right there. And very softly and very quietly, God healed me right there. It says, pray for your enemy. I was praying for me the whole time. It's so simple. It's hard to do, but it's so simple. So and like I said, there's no lightning bolts, no booming voice, clouds didn't part, none of that. It was just so simple. Like I said, God has nothing to prove. So I read this, and I said, that's what I'm going to do. Starting tomorrow, you know, I'm still fighting. Starting tomorrow. I've got my answer right there. It's so simple. And my dad always told me, he said, you pay attention when you read the Bible. The black, it's in black in there, and he said, you really pay attention to the red. He said, it's all important that you repent. And I thought, well, this is red. This is my answer. There's no doubt about it. And I said, I'll do this tomorrow. Well, I put my Bible up. I said a little prayer, thank you, God. And starting in the morning, I'm going to start praying for him. Oh, I was kicking that can, you know. And it's tough praying for somebody that killed one of your best friends, you know. And anyway, I got about halfway to the bedroom, and right there in the hallway, I dropped to my knees, just like getting shot. It's just like my legs come out from under me. And I started praying for him, and it was tough, and I was very reluctant, and it probably wasn't the most elegant prayer you ever heard, but I started praying for him, for his safety while he's in prison, for his salvation, and then I started kind of, and there's his name. He's been on our prayer list here at church for several months, because I thought, you know, look at what all of our prayers do, you know, and that's another thing me and Richard's talking about, and Mike too. It amazes me, and always has, that as lowly as we are, You know, we can't call the White House and get the president on the line. But all we got to do is sincerely pray, and we can speak to the maker of the universe, the creator, our God, you know. And it's amazing to me. Well, he heard me praying, because from that night on, the nightmares started getting better. And I started examining myself and looking at this guy, and I started realizing how much it had been about me. It was because of Brett, but it was me. I was the one that was doing the hating, you know. And I first started thinking, if I let him keep eating at me like this and this hate, then he's still punishing us. He's still hurting us. He's being successful. Well, the more I prayed, the more I got to looking at the pictures of him and stuff, I thought, you know, this is somebody's son. This is somebody's family member. I don't know what happened in his life. I never asked. All I know is he got a rap sheet, and the whole thing's about as long as my leg. The long leg, not the short one. And it's amazing that all those years, 20 years, I was getting just eat up with this poison, which will eventually kill you. If not physically, then it will kill you spiritually. And what's the difference in the long run, you know, if you think about it? So I started praying. Pray for him, and it got easier and easier, and I started expanding my prayers, you know. And now I'm praying, I don't know. And I'm going to try to write him a letter and tell him that I forgive him and everything, and I want to find out if he's been saved. I want to know. And we're praying for his salvation in the meanwhile. But that's the second healing for me. Now, I would still like to get him alone in a room with no gun. And if I could get him alone in a room and lock the door, what I would do is I would walk straight over to him and look him in the eye, and I would very humbly ask him to forgive me. Because I hated him, and the malice aforethought that he showed killing Brett, I've been doing it for 20 years. His happened in an instant. I'm worse off than him, you know. I would like to, and in my letter, I'm going to ask him to forgive me. But if I get him alone in the room, I would look him in the eye, and I would ask him to forgive me. And I would hope that he would. And I'd tell him that I forgave him several years ago. And I would hope that we would shake hands, and we would leave there as spiritual brothers. And I ask you guys to remember him when you pray. Remember, all the altars are involved. Now, I got one more thing to say, and then I'll shut up, I promise. And this is important. And Pastor Richard and I talked about this. I have achieved this healing from a merciful God because I've done what we were told to do. Now, how many times every week do we pray for our troops at church? We do it at home. We've got a prayer board at home. His name's on there. We got our troops on there. We pray for the president, for our leaders. We pray for, you know, everybody, all the good guys. He wasn't a good guy, trust me. But I'm praying for him, and it helps me. And everybody says they can see a difference in me. And hopefully, somehow, some way, it'll help him. But what a novel idea to do what God told us to do. What if we pray not just for our troops and not just for our leaders and our police and first responders? What if we actually pray for our enemies like we were told to? How many of you prayed for ISIS this morning? No hands? I did. I'm not sure it's doing any good, but they say they're getting, you know, their numbers are getting decreased and we're winning, whatever. So I like to think I got a little dab, you know, probably not, but, you know. What about the Taliban, and have people prayed for them? What about Kim Jong-un, what's his name, over North Korea? Go to the last slide, Mike. This is the last one. If we think for a minute, and Pastor Richard gave us a great sermon last week on this, and it's one of my favorite stories out of the Bible. My daddy used to have an old saying. He had a bunch of them, mostly get wood, mow the yard, clean your room, all that. But when I would tell him what I'm going to do, especially whenever I was headstrong, 16 years old, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, do that, he'd say, and I know he didn't come up with it because I heard my grandmother say it. He says, a lot can happen between here and Damascus. Well, all them other sayings, I knew what they meant. Get wood, get a whooping otherwise, you know. But I didn't really think about this until I was pretty much grown. If the Lord can change Saul of Tarsus, think about what he could do to all of our other enemies out here. And he can do it. There's no doubt about it. But it's just a suggestion that when you pray, I think you'll find peace, and I think you'll find God's grace if you include your enemies on that list. I'd never presume to tell you what to do or say that I'm right, but I can tell you what works for me. And it's helped me. And you never know. If enough of us start praying, maybe we'll soften their hearts, change their hearts, help our own. But I think it's really a blessing to sincerely pray for your enemies. And if it wasn't, he wouldn't have told us to do it. And that's all I got. And I'm sorry it took so long, but it's painful to tell a lot of this stuff. And I have been absolutely honored to be here to tell you, and I've been blessed by it. And I hope somebody's got a little blessing out of it. But remember that, you know, when you think about praying for your enemies, a lot can happen to them here in Damascus. Thank you very much.